Clean contact.
I'd hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment, or the moment defines you.
Here it comes. Oh my goodness.
Hello and welcome back to the Golf Practice Podcast. After a great Thanksgiving break, we are back with Ty Libby and Peter Donahue. Guys, welcome back. How was your break?
Hey, Andy, it was great. How was yours?
Mine was fantastic. I went to my aunt and uncle's ranch house overlooking Carmel Bay and the 18th hole of Pebble Beach, and it was beautiful. 5-minute walks from the ocean. You could literally see the ocean from where I was staying. And today I woke up to an ice storm, and my detached garage couldn't get in the keyhole, so I had to bring a lighter out and melt the ice around the handle to get into the garage to drive to work this morning. So we're not in California anymore.
Different extreme of weather.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Peter, how was your Thanksgiving?
Good. Stayed here just with family for a couple of days, Thanksgiving Day, and then Friday. It was just terrific. Had a great time. And then this morning I woke up at 5 o'clock and worked until 9 o'clock digging out from the blizzard.
It's kind of strange to be talking about golf when there's a blizzard outside, but I guess it's never.
That's
never.
Why we built this place.
Yeah.
You know, so, and there we have in the cube, we've got Carmel Bay, and we're about to get into a subject that really for me all began back in that area where you were just vacationing.
Great. Yeah, we are starting a new series, or maybe a new couple episodes, on the book called The Inner Game of Golf by Timothy Galway. And Pete, you gave me this book maybe about a month ago and told me to read it, and I've been reading it, and I thought it's been so good that we should share these ideas with some other people. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, like you were saying, when you first came upon this book and how it's inspired you or why you like it?
Yeah, well, I knew back when I went to college back in 1968, that teaching was going to be something that I was very interested in doing, and I was an interested golfer, as we've discussed. I had ambitions for myself, but then as I realized that the world was filled with a lot of golfers that were a lot better than I was, it still didn't dampen my interest in pursuing golf, but not as a player so much as a teacher. And so I was drawn to works that had to do, books and videos, whatever I could get my hands on, that had to do with learning. There was plenty written on golf, as any golf lover knows. You can have libraries filled with books. And when I got into the golf business, the books that I was urged to look at were, as we've discussed, you know, Hogan's book, Search for the Perfect Swing by Cochran and Stobbs. It was a team of British scientists that were commissioned by Sir Ainslie Bridgeland, who was wanted to know if there was a perfect swing. And so that was the beginning of scientific studies on it. Homer Kelly had written The Golfing Machine, which is an amazing kind of catalog of different kinds of swings and pieces of it that could be put together. And so Galway's work on the inner game stood in real opposition to all of these technical manuals. And it was really the first of its kind that really looked at, you know, how we learn. It started to ask those questions and how we perform. The first book I read was actually The Inner Game of Tennis, and that was back in the mid-70s. And then Galway applied the things that he had learned and to his own quest to learn golf, because he was a tennis pro originally. And then finally, he was a good friend, or is a good friend, of Michael Murphy's. And Murphy founded the Esalen Institute, which is out near where you were just vacationing, back in the 60s and the 70s. And Murphy wrote the classic Golf in the Kingdom, which was a story that absolutely grabbed me and a bunch of other people in my generation, and really, I think was the catalyst for my taking this idea that I would become a golf teacher from, you know, being a good intention to a real commitment. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds that what drew you to this and even to golf teaching was not so much the technical aspects, but I don't know, how would you describe it? The deeper, what's behind it? How it's about learning, or what would you?
Yeah, I would say that that's it. I think that anybody who has, quested for golf, you know, in solitude, understands some of the things that Galway is talking about. I mean, there you are in the quietude of an afternoon or a morning, and you're hitting shots on the golf course or on the driving range, and you're looking for something. And you're if everything's very quiet, I mean, sometimes what you become aware of is that there's a voice in your head, or at least one, and it's kind of interesting to follow that voice and see how it either helps or hinders you. And then, you know, to see what happens when it's not there. And when you, you know, kind of let go of the trying and, see what happens. And the miracles that that I experienced, and I bet you guys feel the same way, you know, that you can find from these, like, not trying moments are amazing. And anytime you get that kind of an experience, you wonder, how can I get more of that?
Yeah. So maybe the way we're going to go through this is, rather than asking everyone to read a book, I mean, I don't know if anyone reads books anymore. I know you guys.
I do.
You do? Yeah. Well, good for you, Ty. the rest of the world just listens to podcasts. So we're going to take a few of our highlights, kind of from the book, and we'll read them and then we'll discuss them. And our own experience with his ideas and things like that.
If human beings did not have a tendency to interfere with their own ability to perform and learn, there would be no inner game. Similarly, if golfers hit every shot as well as they did their best ones, there would be no inner game of golf. But the fact is that because of self-interference, few of us perform up to the level of our potential for more than brief moments at a time. Learning to get out of one's way is the purpose of the inner game.
Thank you. Well, Ty, do you think he's onto something?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, first, I'd be more interested in hearing about Pete talking about the good voice versus the bad voice in your head, because, you know, sometimes I have single swing thoughts that I feel help me, while others certainly hurt me, and I do need to get them out of the way to improve or to try and get better. But yeah, that strikes a chord with me. You know, because of self-interference, few of us perform up to the level of our potential for more than brief moments at a time. And so those are the moments on the golf course where, when I hit a great shot, I try to celebrate it as much as I can in my head. And, if I hit a bad shot on the very next opportunity, which is not uncommon, you know, just try to move past it and focus on the good shot. But yeah, it's tough. It's such a difficult game. There's a lot of opportunity to get down on yourself. So
yeah, I think golf is so quiet and you're by yourself and you're not really reacting to, you know, a ball being thrown at you or a player running at you. And you just have to, it's just only you out there and you're the one who has to go hit the shot. And so I think all of that space and time and quiet leaves the opportunity for, I guess, yourself to get in the way of it. For me, it tends to be if I start out, or at least over my life, it's been if I start out playing poorly, I tell myself I'm always going to be like, this is going to be a bad day. I'm going to play. If I bogey the first four holes, I don't have it today. But then also if I start out well, like if I birdie maybe two of the first four, myself tells me, like, this won't last.
When's right? the bogey coming?
When's the bogey? Like, yeah. And I always, it always just reverts back to the middle. Well, Pete, do you have any self-interference in your game, or what does this, anything stand out to you in this kind of paragraph?
Well, yes. You know, I think that it's interesting. He says if human beings didn't have a tendency to interfere with their own ability. And then the second sentence is if golfers hit every shot as well as they did their best ones, there would be no inner game. Well, I think that there wouldn't be a game. You know, I mean, the marvelousness about golf is that it's such an interesting challenge that, you know, people can only succeed at it, you know, a certain, like, half the time. I mean, that's the definition of a good game. So partly, you know, what he's saying in here, or at least to me, is like, wait a minute. You know, I kind of question that second sentence a little bit because – yes, there would be no inner game of golf. There would be no game of golf. It wouldn't be challenging enough. It wouldn't be interesting enough for us. But and so I think that that what he's really talking about is what you guys were just talking about. And he's also included in that. Not only is it the, you know, the worry about whether we're going to fall off the high wire or not. But it's also also the voice that's telling us how to do what we're doing, instead of, you know, giving over the execution of your swing to some more zen-like state of mind, you know, where the archer doesn't actually let go of the bow, it lets itself. You know, it's one of those things that Western minds has a hard time, you know, grasping. But you know, I think that that the kind of things that Galway gets people to do is to literally play, you know, out of their minds, because they're using their minds in such a different way.
Yeah, so he would say that he would say golf is more about he would talk about learning golf is not just about perfect mechanics. It's about, I don't know, knowing your swing and trusting yourself and, yeah, letting go of, like, the tendency to try to over-control everything. That he would say that is actually, like, if you can find a way to overcome that, if you can try to overcome that self-interference, you would get better a lot quicker than taking one golf lesson. Yeah. It seems like he is kind of where he's going with this.
I think, you know, he would say, well, it's important, you know, to develop an awareness of the club face. And once you do, once you experiment enough with it, you know, is to hit things open or closed, and to begin to register how that feels, and just explore that more. That that would be more reliable than starting out saying, you know, keep your head down and keep your left arm straight. I mean, those kinds of the kinds of instruction that I grew up with, as a, for instance, which was, you know, if you're slicing the ball, stand with a closed stance, or vice versa. If you're hooking the ball, stand with an open stance. And what's missing in all of that is the connection to the club face hitting the golf ball. It's like there was never a an explanation as to how that kind of tip would work, and therefore it didn't work all the time. And the reason that it didn't was that there was a sort of an unconscious awareness and knowing of your mind that you were detached from. Like if you were used to coming in with a club face open, and there was something in you that actually, unbeknownst to you, said that's really important, and that may be from 20 years ago. You know, when you hooked the ball all one summer and you promised yourself 20 years ago that you would never suffer like that again. So you built your golf game around this open-faced feeling. And instead of acknowledging that, you're going to some tip that's on a really has another thing to do with cause and effect. There's so many things like that when I grew up that the teachers just forgot to let you know that there was a club head, and you ought to know about it. Yeah. Galway goes and says, no, let's pay attention to the club head, and then let's just swing from that acquired feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's much more learning where the club head is than these, you know, quick fix tips, which are, I mean, you said that's how it was when you were, you know, earlier in this business, but it still is there today, you know, so much, someone tops a ball, the first thing next person in their group will say is keep your head down.
Right.
And or like you said, if you're slicing the ball, okay, stand with a closed stance, and then that works for maybe a round or two, but then in after that, you're so messed up because you haven't learned anything about the club face, you have another problem that then you just band-aid another quick fix over, and you never actually get that much better. I guess you could if you can have an instructor with you once a week. You know, for the rest of your life, they could always Band-Aid fix you, but you never really learn about your swing or where the club is or how to control it.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And then when we started, you know, our teaching, which goes all the way back to, you know, Winnetka in the early and mid 80s, you know, we were looking at how it was that we were brought up in the game and questioning, you know, how good that was, and looking, you know, for ways to empower ourselves, to understand better what we were doing, and to free ourselves up to be able to do it better. So what Galway got us to do with really concrete exercises was to place instead of placing our thinking analytical mind in the middle of our golf swings, he said, why don't we quiet that mind down so that we can open up your awareness to what is actually happening, not what you're trying to make happen. And so if you can pay attention to that and report on that, then let's see what happens. And, you know, it's a very, very, I find that it's a very, very necessary mindset. That's why when you ask me what book should I read, because, you know, I want to learn the teaching arts, you know, that although I hadn't looked at the book in a long time, you know, to me, that's the place to start. You can do all the technical stuff after that. But, you know, how we learn and how we perform, you know, this is what Tim Galway was getting at.
Yeah, he talks about yourself one versus self two, which you were getting at a little bit as you were talking. And self one, he says, is the self that knows everything, that instructs you how to do everything, that says turn your hips through or, you know, flip your hand, whatever your self one tells you to do. And then, but then self two is the one that actually does the playing, right? That self two is the one that actually hits the ball, and the self one kind of the wrong way would be self one tells self two exactly how to do it. But what he's talking about here is let's get self one out of the way and just trust self two to hit the ball, and you'll actually do a lot better.
Yes. You know, you know, I've always had one foot in each camp, but, you know, I remember going through an exercise some years ago where, you know, after a relaxation posture and a guided visualization, the instructor asked us to to take a ping pong ball. We were standing about 8 feet away from it, and try to throw it with your non-dominant hand into a Pilsner beer glass. And I rimmed it out, and the guy next to me drained it. And what did we know about throwing with our opposite hand, our off hand? All we were doing was we were in a very quiet mind state, and we were focused on what we wanted and just did it. So, and I was aware when I let it go that there was a flinch in what I was doing. You know, I mean, it was, I wasn't willing to trust that completely. It's like why I can't be hypnotized, you know, because there's that last sort of letting go that I, to this point in my life, I haven't really been able to do it under any circumstance. I certainly can do it, you know, with a golf club, with a putter, or with a, and, you know, and I have done it, you know, many times under very stressful circumstances. But so it's a fascinating exploration. It's a great, great way to go. And, you know, I think that what we're doing, what Chris and Arthur are doing with our M360 program is exactly that.
Mindfulness training.
Yep.
So I've had good experiences with, you know, hitting a great shot and then thinking about it and what led me to hit a good shot and realizing, okay, I wasn't thinking about foot positioning or hand positioning or shoulder rotation or whatever. And so, like you were saying, almost a zen-like feeling before hitting the ball, having an empty mind and not thinking about technique. But then I've also had those moments when I do the same thing, have an empty mind, and, you know, just hit a shank. And so is there some reason for, you know, and then I'm like, well, of course you hit a shank. You need to be thinking about your shoulder rotation or your hand position or whatever. Does Galway talk about that at all?
Well, that's, first of all, that voice that's in your head saying that is his self one, you know, saying, well, of course I told you couldn't trust that.
Ah.
You know, you need to come back here to the ego and to the analytical side. You dare not trust that voice. And, you know, it comes to us, I think that it comes to us from, you know, our earliest times when your mother said, Ty, if you'd been more careful, you wouldn't have made that mistake.
And she said that lots.
Well, I do think, and I do think that's what brings us back, is that we make mistakes. And it's not enough for us to accept that. We strain against that inevitability, and we act as if the mistakes that we make are things that we need to correct, instead of just saying, "Hey, you know, I'm just going to go on to the next thing," and you know, do my best, you know, refocus myself. Now, if it's a chronic mistake, well, then, you know, we need to go into the repair shop. Uh-huh. Where self one and you know, self one can outline a bunch of diagnostic tests, or you know, try a couple of different approaches to solving the problem. One of them might be, you know, a technical, mechanical solution, and one of them might be a more global solution, like, you know, let's act as if, or let's just let go, or let's try to hit it. Like I do a lot of times when someone's shanking, you know, I think that curing the shanks is one of the most significant things you can do for someone, because shanks shut the game down. If you're swinging and you're trying to hit the center of the golf club and you're hitting the shaft, you know, that and you're scooting everything off to the right on the ground, that's a terrible thing. And I remember, you know, as a kid, how bad that could get into your head. because I was out one night on the course, as I frequently was, playing by myself, and this old man came up in a golf cart, and he said, "Hey, do you mind if I?" And I said, "Please play through." He said, "No, I'd love to join you if you wouldn't mind." I said, "No, delightful." And so we played along, and I hit a shot to the green, and I pushed it off to the right. And I had a habit of saying in those days when the ball went right, "Oh, I shanked it." And as soon as I said that, this man started yelling as if I'd stuck him in the butt with a barbecue fork. And I didn't know why. And then I saw, because he shanked the next seven balls.
Because you said it?
Around the green. Oh. Once, and that's the way shanking and problems in golf, you know, so often are. They reside in this mysterious realm of superstitious thinking and suggestibility. So how you gain power over that, I think, so shank cures, I think, are really important. And how I do it most of the time is develop... stimulate the player's awareness to where the ball is being hit, and then go through a series of contrasts and overcorrections, so that we're starting with an idea like, well, if you're aiming at the center of the club and you're hitting it in the heel, that's the same as having three tin cans on a fence post and you trying to shoot them with a bow and arrow or a gun, and every time you aim at the center one, you hit the one on the left. Well, how many times is that going to happen before you aim at the one on the right? And so we start aiming at the toe and or even missing the ball to the inside, and it's interesting to see how slowly that contact changes from the heel, and it just comes out. And even though the player thinks they're aiming at the toe, and what the experience starts to reveal is how little we actually can control ourselves with our conscious mind. That it really is a process of learning and giving up, you know, what our current intention is, and really swinging out there and risking. In the case of shanking, the first thing you have to do is miss the ball, swing away with the club, ball lined up in the center of the club, and then come back and miss it to the inside, and then try to just nick it with the toe of the club. Well, people have a very difficult time freeing themselves from the insistence that they have to try to keep doing what they've been doing. And so they keep hanging on to that thing and keep shanking it until finally they get exhausted, and then that self one gives up and says, "Okay, I will try to hit it off the toe now." Mm-hmm. And then, only then, does it start to change. But the quickness with which people then want to jump to, "Oh, that's my key."
Yeah.
And that's not the key. That's the beginning of a process that goes, okay, let's see if we can recalibrate you through your awareness and see if we can actually get you to hit it off the toe. Once you start hitting it where you intend to hit it, well, then you can go back to aiming at the center of the golf club again. But that's how, you know, that's how errors occur in golf. There's something at work. Self-one, this, you know, neocortex executive function thinks that it's really the master of the castle. And, you know, it has a hard time accepting that there's a lot of things about the mind and the body that it doesn't know about.
Yeah, I think that's a good example of kind of the difference between the inner game teaching and what do you call outer game, or more the more traditional teaching. So if in, I don't know, Golf Digest land, if you're shanking the ball, what would like a quick fix tip be?
Well, it might be, and it might be, you know, the same thing that I do. Just say, "Oh, well, you know, you know, aim at the toe. It's a very, very often what happens is in those kinds of articles, someone might say, well, the reason for shanks is that you're taking it away too much to the inside and with the face shut or something like that. So cure your shanks by this new takeaway method. Mm-hmm. Or it could be that, you know, you're coming in, just try to hook the ball.
Yeah.
If you're shanking it. And so you sort of roll the toe over at it and stuff. And, you know, these things can work, absolutely. But, again, it's one of those things, it's kind of like throwing salt over your shoulder.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if your cure doesn't have something to do with your awareness of the club head hitting the ball, then, you know.
So that's very interesting. So the idea of the intentional miss in practice, you know, I'm going to hit this with the toe. I'm going to intentionally try to miss this. You guys like other sports besides golf. Can you think of any other, like, are there free throw coaches that are saying, okay, now try to hit the front of the rim, hit the back of the rim? Are there baseball coaches not saying, now try to hit it off the handle or hit it off the end of the bat? I've never heard that type of coaching before, but it's an interesting concept.
I know that there is, setting your using your mind in creative ways is something that I listened to years ago to a great conversation between Peter Jacobson, Mike Reed, Johnny Miller, and a PGA golf professional teacher named Chuck Hogan. And all these guys talked about, you know, the creative ways that they use their mind. Like Mike Reed had this wonderful visualization that he used on the putting green of like a parade route that was lined by singing worms. And he would imagine, you know, he would imagine that, and that would guide him, and he just, you know, hit his ball through along this walkway, and so I know that there is that. It's just that the culture that you know, sells magazines and sells commercial time, you know, is selling something else, as you know, And I remember in 1989 when the first international PGA teaching and coaching summit was held, that someone got up and said there were only two golf magazines at a time, but they revealed that it was the editorial policy of the magazine to keep the public confused.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, you can see that in the four examples of shank fixes that you just gave. Is it your takeaway? Is it try to hit it off the toe? But I think it brings up like the bigger point, and maybe one of the bigger points in his book is that the quick fixes maybe will work quickly, but it's actually much harder work to develop awareness and to actually learn something. And his argument is like, that's what it takes in order to actually get better.
Yes.
At golf.
And to really be empowered, you know, mm-hmm. that's the idea. People consume what they want to consume, you know, but when we started the academy, it was with the notion of empowering students. And that was, well, how you do that is you help them learn how to teach themselves. And that's what Galway was really about. He was saying, well, let's use your awareness and do things like build scales, you know, so that you can really experience what is happening. And as your awareness begins to grow, you'll be much more powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think we'll get more into the specifics of awareness and maybe talk about some of the ideas that he has and the examples that he has of them in a later episode. But maybe we'll end this one with this last paragraph about the thesis of the book. You okay reading again, Pete?
I just need to get my glasses on. It is the thesis of this book that the secret to increasing control over our bodies lies in gaining some measure of control over our minds. A basic understanding of mechanics can help, and of course a certain amount of physical coordination is required to play good golf. But differences in talent do not account for the fact that most of us hit much better on the practice range than we do in the thick of battle on the course, nor for the wide variations in our individual scores. The aim of the inner game is to close the unnecessarily wide gap between our potential and our actual performance, and to open the way to higher and more consistent levels of enjoyment of the game.
What do you guys think of that? Or maybe in your own game, the wide gap between our potential and our actual performance.
Yeah, well, I think that when we're stressed, I think the interesting thing about golf to me is that, you know, the driving range is on a scale of stress levels, you know, is a pretty low stress level because you've got a pile of balls, okay, and in block practice, that is, you know, doing the same thing over and over again, as opposed to random practice. In block practice, that is a very low stress level. It's different from one shot, right? But let's just think of the different stress levels. There's a pile of balls on the driving range. There's one ball, mm-hmm. one shot on the driving range. There's going to the course. That's a higher level of stress. There's playing with other people. There's a more expectation that starts to bring in the possibility that you could look bad and be embarrassed. That's stressful. You know, there is the shot with your buddies for the 6-point game or the Nassau, whatever it is. Then there's playing in a tournament. Then there's being in contention in the tournament. And at all of these levels, and this is how we like to test ourselves, and this is part of the fascination that competitive golfers have, is that they want to be tested. They want to find the level where they start to choke. And where Galway says, hey, now this is not, we're not doing, you know, our potential. Why? Because they want to get better at that. They want to overcome that stressor. That's what they're gaming against. And Galway is saying, hey, listen, the way to higher and more consistent levels of enjoyment is the way to better performance. Remember when we talked about this, you know, a number of weeks ago, we just kind of referred to it, that triangle of performance, learning, and enjoyment, you know, that we need to have clear goals in all of those areas, and his book really was a call to sanity. It was to say, hey, let's get what's going on here. You know, you think that you're choking or you're not performing in tournaments because your swing isn't reliable enough. That was the baloney that we were handed when I was growing up. You know, you want to perfect your swing so it stands up under stress. Well, I mean, if you didn't deal with your mind, I don't care how good your swing was, it wasn't going to stand up under stress.
Yeah, today it seems like your swing isn't right or your clubs aren't right are go-to excuses among college golfers that I see, at least.
Yeah, and that's age old. You know, I mean, really, that's the way it was, you know, when I was coming up too, and that, you know, people wanted to not blame themselves, or they wanted to blame themselves very much. Yeah. You know, and Galway was saying, hey, listen, these are two extreme ways of being, and neither one of them is really helpful. Mm-hmm. You know, golf, getting better at golf, yeah, like you were saying, Andy, yeah, if you had some guru that could, like a chiropractor, give you an adjustment before you went out to play, and he followed you around all the time and just gave you swing keys and stuff like that, hey, you know, that's one way to do it if you can afford that. But you know, it's not really very powerful. because you know, when push comes to shove, if you can't be your own swing doctor on the golf course under stress, well then you're less powerful than the guy that can.
Yeah. So kind of on that note, one maybe last question that I have is how much have you found this to be applicable or teachable to children? So maybe in our junior essentials program, very young golfers, is this discussed at this level or, you know, some similar level aimed at kids, or is this more of an advanced, you need to, you know, be in high school or older kind of thing?
Well, I think that what you see with this, let's just take this for an example. One of the things that you'd like to develop in golfers is balance, right? And so the place that we start is, well, we start off balanced, you know, on our feet, and when we swing, we end up in a balanced finish. Well, there's a model, you know, for that. And you can have pictures of it, you know, on the video screen. You can have pictures of it in your studio, that balanced finish. But the ability for number one to give the students a choice and say, "Tell me what you're going to do this time. Are you going to finish balanced, or are you going to finish not balanced?" And let them do what they want to do. You know, is the beginning to me of inner game, because you have a choice, right? You just don't, it's up to you.
Right.
And the next thing to do is then to build a scale and say, well, okay, let's build a scale that describes your balance. If you were perfectly balanced between both feet, that would be zero. If you were a little heavier on your left or lead foot than your right, we'll call that a plus one. And if you were balanced completely on it, that would be a plus two. And if you were actually falling in the direction of your lead foot, that would be plus three. And so you tell me when you swing, and then minus is on your trail foot. Now you tell me when you finished your swing what you are. And so students start to report, well, minus one, zero, plus one, plus, and that's the game. The game isn't to match the model. The game is to report on what is actually happening. And as Galway's theory went, and as I've found it, as we've applied it, that the behavior will start to change. And it will start to change much more powerfully inside in the student, because they're much more of a participant in the process than if they're just trying to be perfect every time they swing.
Yeah. So it's as you're building that scale, as you're becoming more aware, you're actually becoming more balanced, or you figure out that more yourself rather than the traditional teaching would be to be balanced. You have your feet this far apart and you bend your legs and you don't bend over too far and you don't swing too hard, and then you'll be balanced. And so rather than saying do that, you say hit some shots and tell me where your balance is and how it you come off balance and when you fall off balance. And yeah, and then as you become more aware of that, you're able to be in balance more consistently.
Yeah, and same thing with tension. Yeah. You know, if you a student comes in and, you know, I think something is happening. Well, can you feel if it's a matter of tension in the hands, let's say, can you feel when it's happening? Can you feel how tight it is? And then build a scale on that. And then as they do, they start to notice where it is. Now you've turned things completely around on them, because this has always been the role of the teacher, is to tell the student when he sees it happening. And then the student, you know, seeks to change that. It's a completely different experience when you're saying, no, I want you to tell me when you notice it.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, because we're not saying that no one should ever take golf lessons. We're just changing or thinking differently about what a golf lesson or what a golf coach would do and what their role would be.
Yeah, we're talking very much about what that. We're talking about what the role of the coach should be, you know, in order to empower the student. And that's what the coach resides with all kinds of knowledge. The question is, you know, how does he or she apply that knowledge and help the student? The easiest thing to do is just to stand and talk and tell them what's going on and tell them what they need to do. The harder part is to use questions, you know, to see what you can do to engage the student, to get them to open themselves up. And a lot of students, of course, become impatient with that because they don't want to think, many people. They don't want to, they simply don't, you know, and it's not like they're makes them unusual. I mean, Daniel Kahneman and, you know, Thinking Fast and Slow, you know, uses different labels for self one and self two. But he basically says, listen, that thinking part of us really doesn't want to think that much. You know, it would rather just play its hunches, you know, that the intuitive side of us feeds us opinions and judgments about things. And so, you know, engaging the brain and taking on an active student role is something that kids are more open to. But adults who've been schooled, you know, in our educational system, where I wasn't schooled so much to, you know, think for myself. I was schooled to give back the answers that the teacher had given us over the course of the semester, right?
Rote learning, yeah,
exactly. So anybody who's been educated and socialized like that has that habit of being. And so that's one of the reasons that I enjoy teaching children these days, you know, and way more than I enjoy my experiences with most adults, because most adults aren't receptive to that style of teaching.
Yeah. Well, I think that might be a good spot to end for now. I feel like we're just scratching the surface in some of these ideas. So we'll be back to get into some of them a little bit deeper. And Ty and Pete, thanks.
Thank you, Andy.
Clean contact.
I'd hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment. The moment defines you.